From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the controversial world of anti-gravity technology. We talk with journalist Nick Cook about the history of covert aerospace research programs in the U.S. in the 1950s and 60s. Anti-gravity propulsion is the holy grail of fuel-less airplane design. During World War II, Nazi scientists allegedly pursued the technology, as did leading aerospace companies in the U.S. in the post-war era. Also, we'll talk with John W. Jones, an artist who became fascinated with images of slavery on old Confederate money. He's created large-scale paintings based on the engravings of smiling slaves picking cotton in the fields. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the debut solo album from R&B singer Rafael Sadiq. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. The top officials of a large number of the nation's major corporations faced a deadline today to personally certify that the company's financial results are accurate. It's a one-time deadline imposed by the Securities and Exchange Commission. The hope is that such filings will reassure investors shaken by a round of multi-billion dollar scandals. The group in charge of the redevelopment of the World Trade Center site is sending architects back to the drawing board. Andrea Bernstein, a member station, WNYC, reports.
The six design plans for the World Trade Center site unveiled last month are being scrapped. Lower Manhattan Development Commission board member Roland Betts says the commission heard the criticism that the plans were too commercial.
And we also heard, candidly, that a lot of the work looked mundane, boring, pedestrian, and lacked spunk.
Betts said the five new teams would be asked to include some elements of the original six designs, including preserving the footprints of the Trade Center towers as a memorial and rebuilding the New York City skyline. Opening up the redesign process will delay reconstruction. Three new plans are to be presented at the end of the year, with one selected next spring. For NPR News, I'm Andrea Bernstein in New York.
A one-month-old baby girl has been found safe and sound in Texas one day after she was taken from her mother's car. Today, Nancy Crystal Chavez was found in a West Texas town. A sheriff's deputy stopped a car that matched the description provided by Texas's first Amber Alert. The Amber Alert system uses the media and other outlets to help track down missing children. Sergeant Kim Vickers is with the Abilene Police Department. He said it was good instincts and the quick availability of information that led to the child's recovery.
The situation there in Quanah that aroused his suspicion and that, along with the fact that he knew what he was looking for because the information had been spread out over such a wide area so quickly that I think law enforcement officers over the whole country were pretty aware of what we were looking for, and it helped identify this vehicle much quicker.
A woman who had the child when she was found has been arrested. President Bush says he'll do whatever it takes to keep the economy strong. The president made his comments as he began a two-day tour through the Midwest. He told a crowd in Milwaukee that despite the problems Wall Street is currently experiencing, the underpinnings of the economy are still strong. The president also called on Congress to show greater fiscal restraint. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 261 points, or 3%, finishing the day at 87.43. Trading was heavy, with more than 1.4 billion shares exchanging hands. The NASDAQ closed up 65 points, or 5%, finishing at 1,334, rather. And the S&P 500 closed up 35 points, or 4%, finishing the day at 919. This is NPR News. The death toll from flooding across parts of Europe continues to climb. Now more than 95 people have been killed, including five who died today in Germany. In the Czech Republic, meanwhile, rivers are still surging at flood levels in the western part of the country. Bruce Konweiser reports from Prague.
The good news is that the Vltava River finally seems to have crested. The water level is down only a fraction in the past couple of hours, but it is lower. The bad news is that the flood levels exceeded all expectations. The death toll stands at 10, and more than 200,000 people were forced to evacuate their homes around the country. Floodwaters are ravaging some of Prague's historic district, a collage of centuries-old architecture. 100 miles south of the capital, surging waters have virtually submerged Český Krumlov. The South Bohemian city is a World Heritage Site. Meanwhile, the swollen Vltava is still surging north towards the Elbe River, and cities and towns in that area are bracing for the worst. For NPR News, I'm Bruce Kahnweiser in Prague.
Hundreds of people were forced to evacuate a section of Crystal City, Missouri today after chlorine began leaking from a train car. More than two dozen people were taken to area hospitals for treatment of breathing problems. Chlorine gas can be deadly. Officials say the leak began while workers were trying to unload the tanker. An airbag manufacturers association is warning consumers to make sure that when they buy a used car, the car's airbags are functioning. The organization says some disreputable repair facilities fill the place where the airbag should go with rags or paper rather than repair them properly. So far, more than 100 fake airbags have been found in North America. I'm Dale Willman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at www.fordfound.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Last month, a story in the Financial Times of London, written by my guest Nick Cook, reported that Boeing, the world's biggest aircraft maker, was developing a new project called GRASP, Gravity Research for Advanced Space Propulsion. With this news, anti-gravity, the taboo of the science and aerospace communities, took a step in the direction of legitimate research. My guest, Nick Cook, is a former aviation editor for the military affairs journal Jane's Defense Weekly. Over a decade ago, he stumbled on an obscure news article from the 1950s, which heralded the age of fuel-less superplanes, airships which would use anti-gravity technology to attain the speed of light. He began to investigate covert defense programs funded by the U.S. government in the post-war era and secret research projects spearheaded by Nazi scientists during World War II. His new book, The Hunt for Zero Point, traces the history of the quest for anti-gravity propulsion. I asked Nick Cook what he knew about anti-gravity when he first came across that clipping.
Well, I knew absolutely nothing about anti-gravity propulsion. I mean, it sounded like some sort of really cheesy expression from a science fiction comic or a kind of B-movie or something. But as I understood it, as it pertains to the culture of science fiction and what have you, it was some means of propelling an air vehicle without using fuel. If you can manipulate gravity, I guess a little bit like pushing two positive poles of two magnets together, they kind of repel each other. Well, that sort of was my understanding at that stage of how it could be used and put to use if such an impossible thing existed. But, slowly as I looked into it, it became apparent that there was some science underpinning it. And although I am not a scientist, I enlisted some help. But I am a journalist and I've covered secret programs for a very long time. And the signals I was getting back were sufficiently interesting in the early days for me to want to continue pursuing it.
What were the most promising theories for how anti-gravity machines would work?
There are many different researchers working in this field, and they all have different pathways to generating an anti-gravity effect. I mean, for instance, what was interesting to me was that many of these anti-gravitational experiments seem to have a common thread. We have, for example, this guy in Russia called Podkletnov, who's using spinning superconductors. We had the German research, which involves the rapid spinning of a kind of rather weird-shaped turbine to produce an anti-gravity effect. There was another German program I uncovered in southern Poland, which again used spinning. Now, what, of course, these have in common is this spinning factor, which, according to some theorists, say if you spin up this zero-point energy field that exists all around us, some weird and magical things start popping out, one of which is an anti-gravitational effect. As I said before, there's no single pathway to this anti-gravitational effect, but there do seem to be many ways of triggering it. Most seem to involve spinning, and a lot seem to involve the input of high doses of electricity.
So at this point, you suspected that this kind of research had been part of a secret black program that the government had supported in the 50s or 60s, maybe. Where did the trail of this black program in anti-gravity research lead you?
Well, the interesting thing about the pronouncements in the mid-1950s, by this range of companies, was that a lot of people were talking about it. And then suddenly, this is in about the 1955 time frame. And then by 1956, 1957, the whole matter had been dropped. And when I look back over papers and magazines and what have you from the period, it was clear that there was, by 1956, 57, it was as if this debate, which had been raging, I mean, people in the New York Times were being quoted in 1955, and it was as if it had never happened. And, you know, there were two reasons for this, I figured. One was maybe it was kind of all a big embarrassment. You know, people had sort of got all carried away with this world-changing technology in 1955, and then suddenly found out there was nothing in it, and it had embarrassed them. Or possibly that it had been shown at that time to be practical and feasible, and someone had realized its world-changing potential and had said to these individuals, shut up about it. And either way, I wanted to track that down. And that's really how I kind of got sucked into the story. And then, surprisingly, although I went out and I looked into kind of contemporary places like NASA and contemporary aerospace and defense companies, and sure enough, there is evidence that stuff is going on today. But what kept on pulling me back was historical data. Even though I wanted to get my teeth into modern programs in the modern world, the evidence was saying that you need to be looking even before 1955 for the origins of this science.
Well, you researched a 1920s scientist, Thomas Townsend Brown. Who was he, and what's his significance in this story?
Well, Brown is a very interesting figure. He came from Ohio. He was a physicist. He studied under a protege of Einstein, and he had some pretty unconventional ideas. He came up with this experiment, which showed that if you charge a capacitor, that's a device that retains electrical charge, positively on its upper side and negatively on its underside, this thing will rise. It will rise in the direction of the positive charge. Now, science has no explanation for this, and yet you can log on to multiple websites on the internet today, and they will teach you how to build something called the lifter, which operates basically on the Brown principle. And you can go and do this in your home using materials like balsa wood, foil and wire that you can go and buy from a hardware store. But the intriguing aspect is that science has no explanation for how it works.
There is a German chapter to this story. Were the Germans involved in wartime, World War II wartime experiments in anti-gravity?
Yes, they were. The Germans were clearly involved in the Second World War, and this is one of the kind of more disturbing aspects of the story for me. I mean, it was certainly actually one of the more intriguing as well, because my beat is 21st century technology. That's really what I've been trained to do. But I found myself drawn back in time to the Second World War. It's a period I've always been interested in, and it was a period I felt I knew a little bit about. But as I started to uncover what the Germans had been doing, I found that there were two aspects to advanced German high technology during the war. There was the very publicized one, the one that, you know, people like me who are interested in the field know about what the Luftwaffe did, the German Air Force did during the war, and that in itself was highly advanced. The sinister aspect of the story is that most of the Luftwaffe's high technology was taken over towards the end of the war by the SS. Now, of course, the SS were instrumental in the horrors of the Holocaust. And it became clear, though, it is very clear, that they also had a mandate from the hierarchy, from the senior hierarchy, to get into high technology, to create their own state within a state that would give them power within the framework of the Third Reich.
Well, one of the really interesting characters that you researched was a weapons scientist working for the SS named Kammler. Who was he, and what did he create during the war?
Well, Kammler is a very interesting figure, and he interested me primarily from the outset because he so little is known about him, and yet he was one of the most senior individuals outside of the German cabinet, Hitler's inner circle, during the Second World War. His mandate towards the end of the war was to amass all the high technology that Germany produced during the war, and not only develop it. I mean, for instance, the V-1 and V-2 missiles and rockets that were developed and fired on the Low Countries and on England during the war were under his control at the end of the war. But the most fascinating aspect for me was that Kammler set up a secret research cell in Czechoslovakia, which was ring-fenced even from other high-ranking Germans. And within this research cell, he went beyond. He authorized research into weapons beyond the V-1 and the V-2, which in themselves were highly advanced and, of course, became the basis of the rocket program that took Americans to the moon. So Kammler was this mercurial, incredibly unpleasant bureaucrat who had his hands into the architecture of the death camps, for example. But he also took over the German secret weapons as well. And, of course, it's significant that at the end of the war, he disappeared off the face of the earth.
He built the largest underground facility in the world, built by concentration camp prisoners, to work on these weapons. And you went there. It's in the Harz Mountains.
Yeah.
What's it like?
The Mittelwerk is a huge underground facility. It's still there. You can go and see it. It was built to construct the V-2 rockets and other weapon systems. And it was put underground so that US and UK British strategic bombing during the war couldn't touch it. What is remarkable is that Kammler not only built this facility, which was, as you say, the largest underground facility ever constructed at that time, he also built a rat run of other facilities all across his protectorate. And his protectorate extended from Austria through Czechoslovakia into parts of Germany and what is today southern Poland. And I visited a lot of these facilities, and they are still there. They are subterranean, dank, unpleasant. You can really get a feel for the horrors of their construction, what happened to the people who worked on those construction sites, the construction lines for these weapons during the war. And they leave you with this terrible, sort of indelible imprint. And that was a disturbing time of the research. You sort of you come away from it feeling that this stuff kind of sticks to you in a way. And you need to kind of keep your feet on the ground in order to separate the salient facts of the story. And the salient facts of the story are, of course, that Germany developed this stuff, kept it incredibly secret, and then had it, if you like, plundered by the victorious Allies from them at the end of the war.
The United States pursued Nazi scientists after the war, really recruited them. Did they ever get their hands on Kammler's research? I guess the question is, what's the upshot of this World War II Nazi scientist story?
Well, the plant that that Kammler oversaw, it was held. It was actually a sectioned off site of something called the Skoda Works in Czechoslovakia. It was designated to be overtaken by the Russians. It was in the Russians' designated zone of influence at the end of the war. What is interesting, though, is that Patton's army, right at the end of the war, in early May, swept in and overtook the Skoda Works for a brief period of time before the Russians got there. Now, what evidence there is suggests that Kammler got a lot of his research out. We don't know where that research went. Some of it may well have gone to Russia. Some of it may well have gone to the United States. The intriguing aspect is we don't know what happened to Kammler. There are four conflicting accounts of his death. None of them stand up to scrutiny. This was the most influential and most important guy at the end of the Second World War, who had all Germany's secret weapons research at his disposal. And somebody like that, of course, would have had a great bargaining chip to deal with any of the victors, the victorious allies that he cared to have chosen to deal with, to bargain for his life, because Kammler needed to bargain for his life. He was the man who helped to build up the death camps. He had a bureaucratic vision for how the death camps should be created. He was an architect, one of the architects of the Holocaust. So he needed very firmly to bargain for his life, and this would have been a definite bargaining chip, all this high technology.
Nick Cook is an aerospace consultant for the military affairs journal Jane's Defense Weekly. His new book about the history of anti-gravity research is The Hunt for Zero Point. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Nick Cook. He's a former aviation editor for the military affairs journal Jane's Defense Weekly. His new book about the history of anti-gravity research is The Hunt for Zero Point. You followed up on these questions of what happened to the Nazis' wartime research, and you found some interesting stuff. What did you find once you dug around? Who was involved in anti-gravity research in the 50s in the U.S.?
Well, the interesting thing about the 1950s research in the U.S. was that just about every aerospace company you've ever heard of was involved in the field. In 1955, a range of companies like Lockheed, Convair, Bell, these big names from the U.S. aerospace industry from the time, we're all talking about, you know, this coming revolution, the anti-gravity revolution, and that all they needed was some input from the U.S. government in terms of support and funding, and they could crack the science. And to me, what was intriguing was that there was an echo here of what was happening or what had been happening in the pre-Second World War years with fission, with atomic science, where the community was very much divided. You had those saying that if you split an atom, you could get an enormous release of energy, enough perhaps to make a bomb. And those within the field, physicists working within the field, who said it's absolutely impossible. And of course, in the mid-1950s, where these guys were talking about anti-gravity research in the same light, the community was riven with the same kind of dissent, those who said it was possible and those who said it was impossible. So there is this kind of intriguing echo. And again, that gave me some confidence that it was worth pursuing, because we know now the terrible consequences of the atomic bomb.
Why wouldn't people talk to you about this now? I mean, we've been hearing a lot about black programs in recent years on weaponry during the Cold War, about the atom bomb and programs that were cloaked by the CIA, the stealth fighter, for instance. Why hasn't this story surfaced, and why would people still be reluctant to talk to you about it?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons why this story hasn't surfaced. And one of them is that the work is fundamentally, that the potential of this work is world-changing. If you can crack the anti-gravity conundrum, you are not just into something that will change the aerospace industry, you're into something that is going to change our entire world. You can get, according to the people who work in this field, anything to run off this technology. You are manipulating the forces of nature. You are bending the fundamental forces of nature and getting energy from it. Now, that is powerful and it is limitless. So if they can crack this technology, and the evidence suggests that they already have, then it would be incredibly secret. But of course, there's another aspect too, which is that this has been a kind of giggle factor because of its science fiction type connotations for ages. And, you know, you've got to have some nerve to stick your head above the parapet. And that is undoubtedly another factor as well, which has kept this below the kind of the public, out of the public eye. So, you know, these things, I think they all combine to have made it something which has not broken through into the mainstream. But of course, the real draw now is that people are beginning to realize that we are running out of time when it comes to things like fossil fuel. And we need to be looking at alternative power sources if we're going to go through the 21st century and survive into the 22nd.
Could you give us the big picture then on this story? What's the larger significance of anti-gravity research during the Cold War? Does it tell you something about how once taboo and outlandish ideas in science then become mainstream?
Yes, very much so. I mean, I think, as I say at the end of the book, even in the short or relatively short period of time it took me to write it, ideas and the acceptance of ideas, people have become much more tolerant, I think, to ideas which, you know, previously people needed to be kind of rooted in real things that they could touch and see and feel. And science is very much like that. Scientists want all the time to have theory underpinning work to enable them to remain grounded at all times. I too have great sympathy with that. I mean, in my job, I've always wanted to be grounded, to go out and touch the things that I'm writing about, like, you know, stealth fighters or what have you. So, but I think attitudes have changed and they are changing. And Zero Point is always grounded in real work. And mercifully, there are a lot of scientists who are really working right on the cutting edge at the moment. There is a great guy called Dr. Hal Puthoff, works down in Texas, who is really pioneering this whole zero-point energy field and coming up with really respectable theories for how zero-point energy, which is a kind of all-embracing field of energy around us, it's proven to exist. It's simply that we don't know what it can do for us. But Puthoff is one of those people who believes that zero-point energy could actually explain things like gravity, which science has very little explanation for. And I think these answers very soon are going to pop out of the woodwork. I think we're really on the cusp of a whole new era in science and understanding. And if nothing else, that's what I'd like this book to do, is to get these principles to be debated openly without fear of ridicule.
Nick Cook, thanks. It's been an interesting time talking with you today.
Thank you.
Nick Cook's new book is The Hunt for Zero Point. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by IFC, presenting an original documentary that takes a look at 70s blaxploitation films with Pam Grier, Melvin Van Peebles, and others, tonight at 10 on the Independent Film Channel, and by Columbia Records and the James Taylor album October Road, which features 12 new performances, available in stores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, The Color of Money. Images on Confederate currency depicted slaves in the field, just one part of the propaganda campaign the Southern banks waged to legitimize the institution of slavery. We'll meet John W. Jones, an artist whose paintings are based on the engravings on these bills. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Instant Vintage, the first solo album from Rafael Sadiq.
Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. In the mid-19th century, slavery was such an integral part of the fabric of our culture that images of slaves at work picking cotton on plantations and loading it onto railroad cars were emblazoned on the very currency issued by Confederate banks. In early America, banks issued paper money because the New World lacked precious metals, essential for making coins. By the 18th century, printing presses in Boston, Philadelphia, and New York printed bills for banks throughout the country. My guest, John W. Jones, is an artist who's fascinated with these images of slavery on Confederate bills and what they say about our nation's history. He collects Confederate currency and creates large paintings in bold acrylics of slave images from the engravings he finds on it. His paintings, which are exhibited alongside the Confederate bills, are now on display at America's Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee. A catalog accompanying the exhibit is called The Color of Money. Jones first started taking an active interest in these bills when he was working at a blueprint company in North Charleston, South Carolina. One day, he enlarged some Confederate bills for a customer.
On one of the bills, I noticed that there were slaves on the currencies. Being from South Carolina, I, of course, had seen Confederate money before, but I never realized what was on it until I took a very close look at that particular bill. It kind of blew me away, really, because it was something that I hadn't seen before. I'd not seen it in any history books or never heard about it. So it certainly sparked my interest, and I began to investigate this this phenomena, and I began to find more and more bills with African Americans on them.
Do you remember that first bill, what the image was on it?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It was a bill from Charleston. It was a slave family in a field. It was in the lower right-hand corner of the bill. It was very small. If you're not really looking for it, you'd miss it very easy.
What was the slave family doing in the
picture? Well, they were actually in a field picking cotton, just that simple. They were a family basically just out in the cotton field picking cotton.
Now, you're a painter. Were you already then a serious painter while you were working this, I assume, a day job at the blueprint store?
Oh, absolutely. I've been painting and drawing since I was about 6 years old. Back when I was in early childhood, I was drawing on the ground because we didn't really have any paper because my father wouldn't let us draw on paper because we needed the paper for school purposes. So we had nothing else to draw on, but so I had drawn the ground with sticks. And, of course, I developed that talent over the years on through high school and doing bulletin boards for teachers and backdrops for teachers' plays and things like that. So that's basically how I learned to draw and paint, pretty much self-taught.
So you saw this image on this Confederate bill, and you started collecting Confederate money yourself. How did you track it down? Where'd you look for it?
Well, I started out going to Confederate stores where they generally trade old bills, and then I started to look on the Internet. I went to eBay, and I actually found a place where I could bid on Confederate bills, so I started collecting it that way. As I began to paint these paintings and put it into the first exhibition that I had, people actually started sending me bills to paint.
What kind of Confederate money did you turn up? What were the images on the bills that you found?
Oh, they varied widely from anything that you could imagine of the slaves were doing in fields, trundling cotton, carrying cotton, loading cotton, baling cotton, hauling cotton, carrying cotton, picking cotton, you name it, dock work, and on and on and on. It's just a wide variety of chores that the slaves were doing on the old currencies.
Do you have a star of your collection or a really significant bill in your collection?
I think the one that really struck me most was the one that was on a Macon, Georgia bill, and that the painting I call Slave Prophets. It was the one of Moneta, which is apparently the Roman goddess of money. And she had money in a bag under her arms, gold spilling out of a bag by her feet, cotton in one hand, slaves in the background with an overseer, and a train coming to pick the cotton up from the harvest. I think that one really struck me most as to how important cotton and slavery was to the Southern economy.
I'm just looking at the an image on the cover of your book. There are two slaves picking cotton. There, one of them is carrying a huge basket of cotton on her shoulder, and she's a really, really strong-looking woman right. out in the fields, dressed as a man, really, wearing a fedora.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's how the Southerners wanted to depict this female slave as being strong and able to do the work of men, actually. But, of course, I see a different picture. I see the strong and indomitable character of these slaves and how they survived through all of this, the horrendous activities during the antebellum period.
You said you had seen Confederate money before. Do you remember the first time you came across it and what your thoughts were when you saw it for the first time?
Well, I think that was a long time ago. I don't even remember who had it, but I know I had seen it before. It wasn't in any books either. Someone actually had some. I think a lot of people were wallpapering their homes with Confederate money.
They wallpapered their walls with it?
Oh, yeah. It was virtually worthless after the Civil War, but people are collecting it now, so it's becoming quite valuable now. In fact, there's one particular bill, if you get your hands on it, is worth about $50,000.
Now, these images of African-Americans started appearing on banknotes around, I think, 1820, before slavery was institutionalized. What did mm-hmm. the images look like then from those bills? Were blacks even represented on them?
Well, there was actually one bill that I know of that I've investigated that had had any images of slavery on it, and that was in 1820. And that one apparently had no hint of subjugation to it at all, as I can see. It was simply blacks and whites working together on some sort of project. And I'm looking at the bill here as I'm talking to you, and that seems to be the case to me.
And when did that begin to change?
Well, after 1820, there were no blacks on any money until around 1850. And that's just prior to the Civil War. And, of course, the reason that they began to appear on money was because the war was beginning to heat up, the debate over slavery and the system in the North and the system in the South and the migration to the West, and that all became controversial. So the South began to put images of African Americans or slaves on money because this was the whole focus of all of this activity. The slavery and cotton was the backbone of the South, so they wanted to put something on the currency because although it was circulated from the banks locally, it circulated around the country nationally. So that gave the bankers a way to promote an idea, and of course that idea was that cotton was king in the South and that slavery was the instrument that they used to harvest the cotton and get the cotton out of the fields into the market.
Now, I understand something really interesting happened here in the 1840s, late 40s, when the Southern banks started saying to these Northern printers, hey, we want some pictures on the money depicting slavery, our main industry. And the Northern printers just had no idea what to do. They were kind of caught up short. What did they come up with? Did they even know how to portray slaves at the beginning?
Well, they began to, what they had to do, because they had no ready-made images, they had to actually recycle the images that they had. That is, they had to take images of white farmers or the vignettes with showing whites in the fields and change them to blacks in the fields. One particular note, I called it slave picking corn, and that clearly illustrates how they were changing the images from the banks up north and selling the images to the banks down south by changing the skin color and tattering the clothes to make them appear like they're slaves.
Another image in the book that accompanies your an exhibition of your paintings is one that I understand was very popular at the time. The bill was popular. It's of a slave mother holding her child on her shoulder. and mm-hmm. she has an apron full of tobacco leaves, and the child holds a tobacco vine.
Right.
What do you think of that image?
Well, I think that the holding the tobacco vine is part of the very thing that had them enslaved. And you notice the mother is smiling, and the baby is smiling. Well, as we said before, this is all propaganda. In fact, all of this was all about propaganda, about a way to promote that system and try to convince the North that it was just wonderful. And that's why the slaves are all smiling on a lot of the bills that you see. You never see anything about the negative side of slavery on any of these currencies.
There's an abiding debate about the Civil War, to what extent the Civil War was about states' rights or was it about slavery. Do you understand these images on these bills as adding something to that argument?
Well, I think these currencies show a clear and undeniable, irrefutable evidence of how important slavery was to the South. I think it's a visual smoking gun, if you will. There's no getting around it. It won't go away. It's there on the money. It's clear to see. Anybody can see it. I didn't put it there. This is not revisionist history. This is something that's clearly on Confederate currency and Southern states' currencies.
John W. Jones' paintings of images of slavery from Confederate currency are now on exhibit at the Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is artist John W. Jones. His paintings are drawn from images of slavery found on Confederate currency. The catalog which accompanies his work, now on display at the Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, is called The Color of Money. When you started to design the paintings, did you think, I'm just going to reproduce these images faithfully, or did you consider transforming them?
No, I never really considered transforming because I thought that what I would do, I was paint these things exactly like I saw them on the currencies. I didn't want to change it very much, but of course some of the images were so faint and old that I had to ad lib a little bit because when you blow something up that large, you had to put in faces and things like that. So I had to add a lot of that sort of detail and backgrounds and color to bring these things back to life. Was basically my aim to show people and to educate people and let people see and know and understand what was on the old currencies.
What's the scale of your paintings? Can you give us a sense of how big they are? And I'm thinking, looking at them in this catalog from an exhibition, that making them bigger, to me as a viewer, gives the people in these images back their humanity in a way. They really do leap out at you alive and strong.
Right. That was part of my intention as well, to give these slaves a new voice so that they could be freed from this the currencies that they were found on. And that's why I tried to liven it up and really make the colors bright and lively to draw people into these paintings so they can really take a hard look at that subject matter and hopefully to help heal some of the wounds that has been created by slavery.
So when you exhibit, you always exhibit the bills, the money, alongside the paintings. And
absolutely.
I guess you want your audience to kind of read the story between the two?
Right. I think it was very important to put the bills beside the painting so they can juxtaposition to the painting so they could see the relationship between the money and the painting itself. Otherwise, I think it would probably be just another slave or cotton picking painting, so to speak.
When you blow the bills up, can you see the faces clearly?
For the most part, they're just about as smudged as they are on the original bill. So that's why I had to ad lib quite a bit on some of them. But you can see some of the expressions on some of them, and some of them you can't because, they, like I said, they're so small that even blown up, it doesn't help very much.
So what models or what faces do you use for your paintings?
Family and friends, basically. Just people that I know from the neighborhood and things like that. Sometimes I use my face.
You know, I'm wondering, I'm trying to put myself in your position painting these paintings. It takes a while. You work on a painting for, I imagine, what, a couple days?
And generally I have two or three going at one time, actually, because I'm trying to produce a large body of work, and I have to paint on them as I get the inspiration to do so. And a lot of times when I do paint, it's basically in the middle of the night where I don't have the phones ringing all the time and have been distracted by grandchildren and so forth. So I generally paint, start painting around 12:30, 1 o'clock in the morning, and paint on up through 9 or 10 o'clock during the morning, sometimes later.
Well,
but that's generally the way I do it.
Well, I imagine you painting a face of someone you know from modern times into this scene of slavery, and I wonder if that connection, if you make that connection, if it really places you in a very visceral way back in those times.
Well, I guess to some degree it does, because reflecting on my past many, many years ago, I remember my great-great-grandmother. I must have been 12 or 13 years old at the time. And my grandmother took me up to see my great-great-grandmother, which was, I think, probably the last time I saw her alive. And from what I understand from my relatives, she was about 109 years old, and she had some whip marks on her back. And I thought that really got my attention to some degree. But being 13 years old, you don't really think that much about those sort of things until, of course, you get older.
So, she showed you?
Oh, yes. Well, she had a sort of a loose gown on, and you could see her back through the gown. And she was sitting there in a chair smoking a corn cob pipe.
Your family's from South Carolina. Fairfield County, where you grew up, is farming country. Did your family own a farm?
Yes, actually. My father worked on a farm. And he was part of his job was to plant vegetables and things for the state hospital, and we always had food to eat, of course, because growing up on the state farm, we had access to a lot of vegetables and food and stuff like that from the state hospital. So that was a very interesting period in my life, as well.
He worked on the state hospital. Is that the state mental hospital?
Yes, that's a state mental hospital. We lived about a mile from the state mental hospital.
And how much contact did you have with the patients?
Well, quite a bit, actually, because a lot of the patients during the 50s and the 60s were able to come outside the compound, and ones that weren't really severely retarded could come outside of the compound. I had one patient in particular. I remember his name is Isaac Wright, and he used to come to the house all the time and actually sit by the fireplace, and he'd spend his day there until it was time for him to go back. He was almost like a father to me, really.
Now, you were drafted into the Army in 1970. Did you see
right.
combat in Vietnam?
Yes, I did. I was with a aviation company in Vietnam, the 229th Assault Helicopter Battalion out of Binh Hoa, South Vietnam. And we did rescue recon missions. But of course, later on, I got out of the infantry. And I changed my MOS to 81 Echo, which is Army Illustrator, at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. And for the next 5 years, I was an Army Illustrator.
When did you get out of the Army?
In 1978, in Washington, D.C. area. And from that point, I did work for a graphics firm, and I worked there for a year. And then after that, I decided that I wanted to work for myself, so I started doing freelance work until I moved back to Columbia, South Carolina in 1989.
What made you move back to South Carolina?
Well, I just got tired of the rat race in the Washington, D.C. area. I wanted to get back down south to a more easy way of living, I guess. And I sort of, missed home, so I decided to move back. And when I did move back, I worked at the University of South Carolina at the Earth Sciences and Resources Institute for about 5 years. Got married, moved to Charleston, South Carolina. Got divorced, moved back to Columbia. And, of course, that was when I decided that I was going to paint full-time.
It sounds as if you've done a lot of traveling in your home state, driving around South Carolina. Driving past the fields, do these paintings that you've lived with, these images of slavery that you've lived with as you've painted them, do they bubble up in you in any way?
Oh, absolutely. I constantly like to travel along the back roads through some of the cotton field country. As a matter of fact, I stopped on occasion to actually go out in the cotton field and pick some cotton to use as a model to paint some of these cotton on some of these paintings from the cotton fields in South Carolina. Looking at all of the cotton and seeing how massive these fields were and thinking about all of the slave labor that it took to pick this cotton before the invention of the cotton gin, to clean and clean all of this cotton, it had to be in a horrendous time, especially with the during the summer and the hot temperatures that we have in Columbia, South Carolina.
John W. Jones, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Well, thank you for having me.
John W. Jones. His paintings are on display at the Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Coming up, a review of a new R&B solo album. This is Fresh Air. Rafael Sadiq was one of the leaders of the early 90s R&B group Tony Tony Tone, founder of the recent group Lucy Pearl, and a writer-producer for performers like Whitney Houston and D'Angelo. Sadiq characterizes the music on his new first solo album, Instant Vintage, as gospel-delic. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
How about the possibility of you and I? Lady, can we try? Lady, say you with it. If you're not with it, then it. Excuse me.
Can't make you stay.
You wanna go, sugar? I can't make you love me. If your heart says no, but there's one thing I'm certain of, and I know it's true.
That's Rafael Sadiq singing Sweet Harmony with Angie Stone on a song he wrote called Excuse Me. The song is an immediate introduction to Sadiq's skills and charms. He has a smooth conversational vocal style, which he applies to melodies constructed around a gentle but insistent rhythm section. He summons up echoes of Stevie Wonder, Al Green, and Curtis Mayfield, but Sadiq has worked out his own approach to romancing rhythm and blues. Take, for example, this beautiful track called TikTok.
You see, baby, I ain't going nowhere, no. I'm just going to wait on you, girl, I swear. I'm here when you need me, you should know. I can always listen. Cause, girl, you're my baby. Baby, this thing that you're going through, just do what you gotta do, and love will show you the rest, girl.
Listening to that song, you can hear the way Rafael Sadiq sets up the TikTok rhythm from which the song takes its title. That strict, rigid tempo could easily become constraining, but instead, Sadiq's vocal plays against it, teasing flexibility out of it. He sings lines that flutter under and over the pace of TikTok. At the same time, his lyrics never neglect the metaphor of the title. TikTok is a song about time a-wasting, about how you take the regularity of a good relationship for granted at its and your peril.
The streets are paved with fallen souls. I don't know, but I've been told. Cause I ain't never been down that road. The ghetto got a dirty name.
The media burst at their flame.
But tell me really, who are they to say? It's not about your residence.
Damn, what people think of it.
Bush is sitting cozy on a hill. So don't look down, look up high.
Don't let these people steal your pride.
Use that ghetto bullshit as a shield.
That song, People, sounds a little like an updating of the Temptations' 1970 single Ball of Confusion, with a socio-political lyrical slant. But like the best soul artist, Sadiq never becomes preachy, he preaches. There's a difference. Preachiness is off-puttingly judgmental. To preach is to proclaim truth that the speaker holds dear.
I won't cheat on you. I won't do it no more. Like I did before. I can't do it no more. I'm faithful to my baby. To cheat on you. Since I was 12 years old, baby, baby, yeah, baby. But when I first laid eyes on you, I knew it was over for the other cuties. Oh, lady, I could cheat with girls from Amsterdam, but I'll never take the chance, cause I really love you, your style. There could be five naked girls in a room.
If Rafael Sadiq's concept of gospel-delic music doesn't have quite the same punch and inspiration of the best music he made with Tony, 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 well, that's the price you often pay for the benefits of collaboration. But this solo move proves that Sadiq is fully in command of R&B history and is ready to make some of his own.
Ken Tucker is critic-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Seuss Boland directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Being with you, baby, that's gonna make my day.
That's gonna make my day.
Come and help me, darling. I just wanna play.
Ooh, yeah.
Being with you, baby, that's gonna make my day.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Great Deliverance by Elizabeth George, an Inspector Lindley novel and companion edition to the mystery presentation on public television. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Heat Wave, a social autopsy of disaster in Chicago. In 1995, temperatures were so high for so long that the city's streets buckled and over 700 people died. We'll talk with Professor Eric Kleinenberg. His new book is an analysis of what went wrong during an urban inferno. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.